Again, we come to you from Holden Village. Today is June 17th, 1998. And in the Fireside Room, we continue our Bible study this morning with Esther Mann, the presenter. And her series is entitled Biblical Feet, Where Faith Hits the Ground. And today's base is Isaiah 52, 7 through 10. This is tape number MEE 9812.
And this is the third in a series on biblical feet, and I'm trying to connect all these feet with the theme, Guide Our Feet, this week. So today, we're looking at a passage, a short passage from Isaiah 52, 7 to 10, about the beautiful feet of the messenger of good tidings. And I thought that we might get out of that practice of sharing the good news. Although this morning the conversation took a very different turn, and it was an interesting discussion. So I only suggest that as one possible way that we might go with the discussion. What I suggest is that we start by reading this passage in Isaiah 52, 7 to 10, and look at it as a unit, look at it as poetry, try to describe what's going on, what the imagery is, what the message is, and then after that I'll give you a little bit of the historical context, and we can talk about some of the issues that it raises. So we'll just jump right in. Isaiah 52, 7 through 12. Would somebody read that for us? Thank you.
How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messenger who announces peace, who brings good news, who announces salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. Listen, your sentinels lift up their voices. Together they sing for joy. For in plain sight they see the return of the Lord to Zion. Break forth together into singing, you ruins of Jerusalem. For the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has bared his holy arm before the eyes of all the nations. And all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God.
Okay, thank you. This is a short passage, and I tried to relate it to some of the passages around into a longer passage, but the verses surrounding it, it seems to be sort of a collection of short pieces. So we have sort of an independent unit here, 7 to 10. What's going on here? How would you describe action here in this poem?
And there's an announcement being made.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So you have an announcement. You have this messenger with beautiful feet, which is rather a striking sort of phrase, isn't it? Beautiful feet of the messenger. Another way of translating that might be nice legs. Because the the hand in Hebrew, you know, starts here and goes this far, and this is the palm of your hand. So, you know, different kind of ways of dividing the body, and the foot actually starts here. We're talking about a runner, apparently, a messenger who's a runner. And this would be the only means of communication. They didn't have telephones or TVs or anything like that. Email. You'd have to rely on getting news from one place to another through runners, through messengers. Okay, so you have someone bringing a message. And what else do we see here?
It's actually good news for runners.
You know, good news for once.
Sometimes you go to your mailbox and there's nothing but bills and bad news. Here, good news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look how that's repeated and emphasized.
Yeah.
It's even emphasized more than we can see, we see here in your translation, the one who announces peace, who brings good news, who announces salvation, and then you have the actual message, who says to Zion, your God reigns. That's the verbal announcement there. But it's even in the word that's used for the messenger, whose feet are praised here, it's not your ordinary messenger. Mal'ah is the word that's usually used for a messenger, someone who conveys messages like this from a king's court or from the scene of a battle to other areas. So mal'ah is the usual word that's used for messenger. It's also used for angel. So in the Hebrew Bible, there's no distinctive word for angel. It's a messenger. And so the translations interpret. Sometimes you'll have a messenger, even usually if it's in a human context. I'll talk about a messenger in war or whatever, or an angel. So there's no difference. But this isn't that term. It's a different term. It's mevaser, which in itself means one who announces good tidings. So our translation here, the feet of the messenger, is kind of a downplaying of that. Even in that very title, mevaser, you have a bearer of good tidings. And it almost seems that even before you have this verbal message, your God reigns, you see the approach of this messenger, and you see something perhaps by the movement of the feet or the legs, something, you know, about the way the person's running, you sense already that there's good news, even in his very bearing. So it's a lovely image, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet. Or, you know, how lovely are these legs that are carrying this news. That without this messenger, you know, the city is in ruins, right? You ruins of Jerusalem. We hear about the ruins of Jerusalem. And without this messenger, this who has the welcome legs bearing the good news, the city is simply in ruins. Yeah, this is 52. Mm-hmm. This is Isaiah 52.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure, Isaiah 52, 7 through 10. Okay, so what do we also notice about this little vignette, this little depiction here? What's the response to this good news?
Joy.
Joy. Mm-hmm. And even noise, right? They sing for joy. Their voices ring out. They lift up their voices together. They sing for joy. So the sentinels that are, you would imagine them all around the ruined city keeping watch, they all burst out into singing. They're in this ruined city, and yet they burst out into this song at the announcement, your God reigns. And then, for in plain sight, they see the return of the Lord to Zion. What a vision, this idea of the Lord returning to Zion. Although actually the translation there, there were two different possible choices that the translator had. He could translate it as we have here, the return of the Lord to Zion, that's appropriate, but it could also be, for in plain sight they see the Lord's restoration of Zion. Those are two possible meanings of the Hebrew in this passage. This is the problem that you have with translation, right? You can't get those double meanings. Often we have double meanings in poetry, and so the translator has chosen to depict the Lord's return to Zion as a sort of a triumphal king, I think, coming back. Although the other sense, the Lord's restoration of Zion, would also be a possible translation. You see, reference to the ruins
right up there.
Yes. Is this when they're still in exile, or is this when they're back?
Good point here. Let's we can turn to the context here of this passage in 2 Isaiah, where you have this return of the Lord or the Lord's restoration, and all this singing over the ruins because the Lord's comforted his people and redeemed Jerusalem. So are you ready for a little historical overview here? Now,
maybe you weren't ready to get into that.
That's all right. It doesn't make a lot of sense, actually. I mean, I wanted you to kind of just look at it and sort of feel what this little poetry represented, and then I wanted to sort of place it in a historical context. And that this wouldn't be, the historical context that I'm going to present isn't the only one where it would make sense either, right? Because poetry resonates at different times in different people's lives and different communities' lives. But I just wanted to, you know, suggest the sort of the original context. But yes, did you want to say something
just
about
the whole idea of restoration? The city meant everything to the people. Their temple, their city. And so I think the word restoration, for them, that would be good news. Like, our city is going to be restored. And so that word brings that, brings, again, like you said, deeper meaning to the whole thing. Yes, their Lord's to return, but the way they see their Lord returning is the fact that they're going to have their city again. They're going to have their temple again. And all that is kind of part of that too. And that will make more sense when you get into the contextual stuff to see what has happened to the people and why they want to hang on to their city so much.
Yeah, Jerusalem is very important here. And Isaiah, both, all parts of Isaiah actually put a lot of emphasis on the city of Jerusalem and Mount Zion. Last time, in the last session, we talked about Horeb, or Mount Sinai, which is the other great mountain in the biblical story, where you have the giving of the Mosaic covenant, the Sinaitic covenant. And but in Isaiah, really the big mountain is Zion and Jerusalem. Just to complete this, in 10, the work of the Lord and his strength becomes evident to all the nations, so sort of a public display in God's eyes. Do you have a Bible?
Yeah,
great. We're reading Isaiah 52:7-10. And I'm just going to give a quick sketch now of sort of the historical context, a little bit about the book of Isaiah. The book of Isaiah is generally divided into two parts. The first 39 chapters are considered as a unit, and the author of those is often designated as Isaiah of Jerusalem. And Isaiah, the prophet, lived in the 8th century before the Common Era, so the 700s. And at this time, this was long after the united monarchy under Saul, David, and Solomon had divided. And so you have a northern and a southern kingdom. And during this period, Isaiah was living in Jerusalem in the southern kingdom, the capital of the southern kingdom, the place where the temple was, and where the king lived, and so forth. During this period, there was a huge military buildup, and the Assyrians were on the march. The Assyrians lived in what's now Iraq and Iran, and they were one of the cruelest expansionist nations of that time. They had begun to move down, and we're going through the area that the northern and southern kingdoms occupied. They wanted to take all that area, but go down to Egypt. That was always the goal of these great Mesopotamian regions, is to spread out as far as possible. And one way was to go down to Egypt and capture that land too. So in their path, and really kind of on the road, was the northern and southern kingdoms. And so during Isaiah's time saw a lot of movement by the Assyrian forces. And Isaiah, although he saw this movement as part of God's action in history, he, along with the other prophets, saw his own people as being unfaithful to their God and of not living ethical lives. And he saw this as kind of a historical response. So Assyria was seen as the rod of God's anger in all this. But he felt that God, the Holy One of Israel, had a special presence in Jerusalem and in the temple. He had this saying, God is with us. And although he saw the destruction of Assyria as a reality, he always proclaimed that there would be a remnant or a small core that would survive this onslaught and that Jerusalem itself would not be destroyed. So during this period in the 700s, especially toward the end of the 700s, Assyria did come down, and in 722 it wiped out the whole northern kingdom. And so you have the lost 10 tribes of Israel, if you've ever heard that expression. The people, the leaders of the people, are taking to Assyria and displaced. This was a new policy. You just move people around, and then they forget, you know, they're unable to organize, they forget their identity as a people, sort of assimilate, become part of the larger empire. So those that weren't killed off in the terrible actions that the Assyrians took, a lot of them were moved around. And also the southern kingdom surrounding Jerusalem was ravaged as well, but Jerusalem did survive, so his vision was bore out of the historical shape of the history was borne out in that time. Now it's two centuries later, though, after the Assyrians themselves had been conquered by the Babylonians, and the Babylonians have expanded basically to the same area that the Assyrians once occupied, that you do have the city of Jerusalem conquered and the temple destroyed. So in 587, before the Common Era, you have the Babylonians coming in and destroying the temple, which was seen as the special dwelling place of God's glory or his name. There wasn't the crude idea that, you know, God dwelt in the temple, that it was his house. There was some of that, but there were always ways of indicating that God was greater than that. So it was God's glory or God's name, you know, that dwelt in the temple. And even Isaiah of Jerusalem didn't think that God was confined to the temple, because if you remember that great call narrative in Isaiah 6, where Isaiah is in the temple and he looks up and he sees the Lord seated on his throne, high and exalted, and the hem of his garment fills the temple. So it's just the hem of his garment, it really is all that's contained here in the temple, just sort of God's presence, but certainly not all of God's and all of his majesty and so forth. So 587, though, the temple was destroyed, and this could have spelt an interpretation that would have been terribly depressing, because the common understanding was that each city had its own main god or head god, and when that city was captured, then you have a suffering of a defeat of that god who was protecting the city. So with the destruction of the temple, here's a problem: is what's happened? What's happened now to God? You know, is God rendered powerless, or has he been destroyed? What's happening here? There were different solutions to this problem. One solution was offered by the prophet Ezekiel. If we remember, Ezekiel saw the wheel. If you remember, in the first few chapters of Ezekiel, he has this image of this chariot with wheels that can go any which way, just kind of turn on a dime, go any which way, and they, the It's a cherry that has faces. It's rather mysterious, very complexly drawn out, and the presence of God is there, taking this sort of Godmobile, really, is what it is. And he sees, not in the first chapter of Ezekiel, but later on he sees in this vision, God's presence leaving the temple before its destruction, so, and accompanying the people as they go into exile. So in his vision, it's not that God's destroyed or defeated or anything. He just sort of leaves and he accompanies the people as they go into exile. Now, in time, the Babylonians were also defeated by the Persians this time. And the king Cyrus came to rule in around 539. He decreed that those from the exiles from Jerusalem and Judea could return home. Because the Babylonians also had the same kind of policy as the Assyrians did, deporting people and placing them in communities in Babylon, especially the royalty, the educated, those with skills, any leadership they took out. So that pretty much left Jerusalem and that whole area without any leaders, without any way of organizing again. So when Cyrus came to power, he had a different policy. His way of gaining the favor and controlling his empire was to support the local populations and to support their worship of their indigenous gods. And so Cyrus issues a decree that the people of Jerusalem can go home, and not only that, he provides the means to rebuild the temple. So he sponsors the rebuilding of the temple. And it's around this time, just before the return, around the return, that we have these writings starting in Isaiah 40, sometimes known as 2nd Isaiah. And his message is one of restoration and return. So when you have that phrase here, the return of the Lord to Zion, it sort of plays on that image of God going into exile with the people and then coming back to restore the ruins of Jerusalem. So this is kind of the background here. The city is still in ruins, we see. So you're having the announcement of this good news to the ruined city, and yet the announcement is that God reigns and is returning, and the response then is this singing, this ringing cry of joy. Have any questions or comments about this? Yeah.
About how long were they in? Captivity. About just the difference between those two numbers.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, there were different waves of returns, too. And this is kind of interesting. Because, let's see, 858, okay. So around 60 years there. But actually, many people had settled into Babylon, and there were thriving communities there. In fact, the prophet Jeremiah had counseled people, settle in, you know, buy land, set up your businesses, have families, make yourself at home.
A lot of them stayed.
And a lot of them stayed, that's right. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah said, well, it's gonna be about 70 years before you come back. That was his prediction. The people had gone there and to Babylon, and some of them, we learned this from the book of Jeremiah and also Ezekiel, the books of Ezekiel, because Jeremiah and Ezekiel were prophesying around this turbulent time. It seems that the prophets come up in times of crisis. They emerge in times of crisis. And there were prophets and other people that were predicting the return of this community right away, you know, in the short future. It was just a short-term thing. But Jeremiah said, no, you know, it's going to be 70 years. Settle on in. Make yourselves at home, because you're going to be there for a while. When Cyrus came to power, he allowed the people to return, but many people did choose to stay because by that time, they would be what, third generation? Yeah, they were established, they had their families there. And so there were a number of waves of return throughout the 500s. The temple was probably rebuilt around 520 or 515, something like that.
I think it might be interesting to say too that a lot of them probably had abandoned the God of Jerusalem and started to worship the gods in Babylon. So they may not even have felt the need to go back. God, let this happen to our city. Could have been very possibly a lot of conversions.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you say that because one thing you see in 2nd Isaiah is an argument that all the other gods are not only the wrong gods for Israel, but they aren't even gods. That there's only one God. In 2nd Isaiah, you have this emergence of this idea, really of monotheism, because elsewhere, we even see that in the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me, implying that well, there are other gods, but you know, I'm the God of Israel. And be utterly loyal to me, because I'm a jealous God. Now, why, you know, if you're a jealous God, that means there's something to be jealous of, right? That there are other gods, but it's disloyal of the people to make those gods their God. But by the time of 2nd Isaiah, you really do have this emergence of something that we would be more comfortable with, this idea of monotheism, that there is no other God. These other, you know, these idols and, you know, these forms or whatever that people make and worship, they're ludicrous, really. They're not threatening. They're just, they're a mistake. They're a mistaken understanding of the divinity, because there's only one God. And 2nd Isaiah really emphasizes creation as a motif, that God created all the world and all the nations and so forth. And he calls Cyrus. This is kind of interesting. Look at 44. Isaiah 44, toward the end. This is at the end of a wonderful passage that also includes singing. Look, starting at 23. Sing, O heavens, for the Lord has done it. Shout, O depths of the earth. Break forth into singing, O mountains. Everyone's, all of creation is joyful. And so here's an illustration of that kind of emphasis on creation that you have in all of 2nd Isaiah. Thus says the Lord your Redeemer in 24, who formed you in the womb. I am the Lord who made all things, who alone stretched out the heavens, who by myself spread the earth, and so forth. This God who did all this is the one in 26 who confirms the word of his servant and fulfills the prediction of his messengers, the prophets, who says of Jerusalem, it shall be inhabited, and of the cities of Judah, they shall be rebuilt, and I will raise up their ruins. So this God who's created the whole world is now also rebuilding Jerusalem. He says to the deep, be dry, I will dry up your rivers. Who says of Cyrus, this Persian, he is my shepherd. You know, shepherd is royal language here. He is my shepherd, or my king, and he shall carry out all my purpose. And who says of Jerusalem, it shall be rebuilt, and of the temple, your foundation shall be laid. So Cyrus here is seen as God's shepherd, or so the viceroy on earth. And that's made even more emphatic in 45. Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to his Messiah, to his anointed, to his king. So it's pointing to Cyrus, not the Davidic king, as the one who's working out his purpose. So this is in keeping with this idea that God created everything, is in charge of all the nations, not just in particular of Israel's history and so forth. But you know, can choose a foreigner instead of, you know, somebody from the Davidic lineage, can choose a foreigner as his king, or his anointed one who's working out his purposes on earth. That was kind of a long response to your point there, that maybe some of them were worshiping foreign gods. But he's countering that by saying, well, there are no other gods. there are no other gods. There's just this one who's in control of all of creation and control of all of history, and who can choose a Messiah, an anointed one, a leader from any nation. Right? It doesn't have to be Davidic. Rather expansive view of this divinity.
I have a question.
Sure.
It's probably kind of silly.
How did Isaiah actually get this message across the people when they were, you know, scattered? Did they have little synagogues? Were they allowed to meet? I was just wondering.
You asked a really good question because we don't know anything about this person. The second Isaiah, there's no autobiographical material, except maybe there's some of these servant songs where God's servant is somehow abused and persecuted, so some of these may refer to the prophet, but we don't have any depiction of him interacting with people. We assume that this poetry was delivered orally, because the prophets, they delivered poetry. It was like the medium of their message was public poetry, oral poetry. So that's how they delivered their message.
Yeah, I was just wondering if they weren't really suppressed then for their meetings or anything.
We don't know much about the communities in Babylon during this time, but it does appear that they were able to meet because one of the products of that time was the emergence of at least the first books, the five books that are often ascribed to Moses, the Torah. Yeah, they were bringing together traditions. So these are the learned people that are taken out of their homeland and put together in communities. Now they've lost their king, so they lost all their political structure and all their military power and all their land, and they've lost the temple, so they've lost the whole sacrificial system. And they've lost so much that would give them an identity and a cohesion. But these are the educated people, and so what seems to have happened is they brought along with them traditions, varying traditions, actually from different times, kind of a library almost, and that out of this period, you have kind of a process of sifting through the most important of the traditions and sort of editing of these traditions. So it's really out of that context that you have the emergence of something that begins to resemble a Bible, which is kind of a library, really. It's a unique thing. You have, you know, the law material, the narratives all drawn together, the poetry. Apparently some of the prophetic writings also were edited, or at least began to receive their form during this time. So, very evidence of the Bible itself shows that people were meeting and were discussing their identity, what was central to that, and were bringing together the most important parts and making it into a literature, sort of a national literature that told their story. So they did meet together. And this is a rather interesting period. We know so little about it, but we do know that they had to develop other forms of worship, there was either the origin or the further development of types of worship that wouldn't involve sacrifice at the temple and so forth. So singing, prayer, scripture, readings and so forth became a way of worship.
This is also the very beginning of a very nationalistic attitude. Upon the return to Jerusalem, they continue to write things down, and they huddle together. This is my image. They huddle together, and they get this attitude, this is never going to happen to us again. And they get the attitude, We are going to write things down. We are going to be faithful followers to the law. This is never going to happen to us again. And that's just, you know, continuing your line of thought. That's another reason why a lot of this stuff gets written down. Mm-hmm. And they want to pass it on. They want to. They become very nationalistic, and at this point, they almost become very legalistic. And that transfers over to some of the legalism that Jesus encounters. And maybe I'm wrong, but this is kind of my naive understanding. And this is just the beginning, you know, of that legalistic and almost nationalistic. Now, this is never going to happen to us again.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of interesting. There's certainly development of an identity, but it's kind of weird to be nationalistic with no nation and no military. You see what I mean? They're really powerful. So it's certainly not a kind of nationalism.
More of a culturalism.
Mm-hmm. Development of a religious culture. Mm-hmm. That can, interestingly, survive outside or inside the land. You know, it has a certain flexibility now because of this hardship, actually, that develops out of this hardship. And there is an attention to how to be faithful to the covenant in everyday life. You're right, and you described that in terms of legalism, but I think that sort of an inside perspective on that is, okay, if you don't have a nation set up, a king, if you don't have a temple and all those rites associated with, well, what distinguishes you, or how do you live the godly life within the covenant, right? So it has to be sort of the actions in your everyday life, all right? So everyday life sort of becomes the arena in what you eat and how you spend your week, you know, the Sabbath, and other things like that become very important as a way of definition. So I wouldn't describe it in terms of legalism so much as practice, the kind of theme for the summer almost, you know, daily practice and how do you identify yourself as the people of God? How do you place yourself? How do you place your lives within the context of the covenant when, you know, so many of the things that were sort of important to that self-concept are gone. So now it's, you know, your daily life. How do you live your daily life? The practices that you have. So that's kind of, what do you think about that? And the thing about sort of the exclusion, it's interesting that you have different strands. On Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah was incredibly inclusive with, you know, his concept that Cyrus, the Persian king, could act as God's viceroy on earth. You know, it wasn't even a Davidic king. So he says, sure, well now it's Cyrus, you know, maybe some other day it'll be some other nation that's going to be sort of leading things here and implementing God's will on earth. And also, I mean, he talks about the nations coming and that the eunuchs shall serve in the temple, I mean, the main, he just has a very inclusive concept of who's part of the people of God. Now, you're right, in Ezra and Nehemiah, there's more of a concern to sort of, okay, now we have to sort of get our identity right. We can't be that inclusive because then we lose all our distinctiveness. So there's that tension. How do you retain any kind of identity and not just sort of assimilate, you know, get so big?
And as in any culture, you know, certain people can take things to extreme. Mm-hmm. You know, can take things to extreme. Thanks, Stefan.
All right, thank you. So we have then 2nd Isaiah. We don't know very much about him, but he's emerging from and speaking to the community in exile in Babylon. And you could really call him a kind of spin doctor, or he's promoting the return. I mean, this place is ruined. You know, there's nothing, it looks like there's nothing there, right? But he's presenting, he's really, there's all this imagery of singing, and he opens it up. Isaiah 40, the beginning of Isaiah, is a beautiful opening. Also very familiar words, I think. Where do we know these words mostly from? How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messenger. So then, what?
Songs.
It's a song.
It's a song, uh-huh. Is it a song that you sing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Our church sings it.
Your church sings it. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely incorporated into Christian worship. People might think specifically of Handel's Messiah.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Right? Mm-hmm. And here's another one that's incorporated into Handel's Messiah, 40, Comfort. Oh, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, and that she's received from the Lord's hand double for all of her sins. So the opening words are of comfort. Okay, this period is over. How many people were at the film last night? Anybody? A few people? There was interesting discussion in the earlier section, because this became a kind of a troubling understanding of catastrophe, you know, as punishment for sins. And the person who raised the question, well, you know, how can you understand that? You know, in light of the Holocaust and so forth, this kind of understanding of history is kind of responding to the sins of the people or whatever, and God is punishing, which is a very serious question. We actually ended up spending much of the period on that question, so I don't know if that's of interest to you. But the whole motif that he raises here is that exile's over, so time now for restoration. And the Lord's returning to the city. This is such familiar material, isn't it? I mean, we hear this in the Messiah, and also this 3:4 we associate with the Baptist preparing the way for the Lord, for Jesus. In this context, a voice cries out, in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, for the returning of the Lord to Jerusalem. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places like a plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. So the depiction of a kind of a leveling for the return, this return to Zion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Going to the question that you discussed the first, is your sense that in that period there was the sense of justice that, or was it like it is now, where there's something you want to believe that you do right and things will be good and there are more complicated views? Or was the religion at that point more, the faith at that point more based on, well, if you do certain things then life will be better?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is your
the dominant portrayal, if you look at the prophets and in Deuteronomy and in the histories here, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings, sort of the dominant view is that God's acting in history, and the people have a covenantal relationship with their divinity, and that means that he has protected them, brought them along, brought them out of slavery and so forth, into a freedom to have this relationship, and that it involves ethical behavior. It involves, first of all, allegiance or loyalty to Yahweh, to the Lord, to this one God who's brought them, who's shown them this kind of favor. So there's this sort of history of mercy, and then there's this expectation of, okay, now remain loyal to me, and that means having no other gods before me. So I'm you know, the king, basically, tying into this image of the Lord reigns. And then there's this whole set of expectations for the people to live ethical lives. So you have the Ten Commandments and all the other kind of ordinances and so forth about behavior, ethical behavior. So those two things, religious loyalty and ethical behavior are sort of demanded of the people as a way of placing themselves within this relationship. And so the dominant view is that when the people begin to worship other gods, or when there's injustice and terrible treatment of the poor, or the weaker members of society, well, then that the people have gotten outside of that relationship that was set up, and so it's kind of movements of armies and so forth is seen as God sort of rectifying that situation, as that there's sort of a this image of sort of punishment or whatever, and then a return. Then the people realize what they've done, and then they return, and then there's a restoration. So there's these kind of patterns that are set up. So I would say that that's the dominant of history, and it's unfolding. So it's not random, and that it's all part of this relationship that God has with the people.
Is it hard for us to understand, partly because we're so individualistic too, do you think? Mm-hmm. Because in some senses, is it a vision of the whole people,
mm-hmm.
and God interacting with the whole people? So if individual misfortune comes, it doesn't get to be so much, well, you stepped out of line,
mm-hmm.
so God's that too. Is mm-hmm. that part of why sometimes we look at the way you do?
It might be that individual aspect, but also just doesn't. It seems like some events, like the Holocaust and other things, that they don't seem to fit into that pattern at all. And actually, the Bible offers other understandings of suffering in the world too. Besides that, even though that's sort of the dominant, I would say that's the dominant model, the more pervasive. And you see that behind this work in Isaiah. But you have. You have the prophet Habakkuk protesting, saying, well, maybe we weren't perfect, maybe we aren't perfect, but these Babylonians who have conquered us, they seem to be worse. So, where's the justice in that? This doesn't seem to be right. So there's these protest voices that say, no, this isn't right either. And the only answer he gives is wait and see. It hasn't all sifted out yet. Wait for the justice of the Lord will come, blah, blah, blah. So there's protest voices that, this doesn't seem fair. And then there's also, the book of Job, where he hasn't done anything wrong. So that's clear, he's an upright person, and he suffers all these terrible things. So there's an acknowledgement that, no, not all suffering is due to people's sinfulness. And we know, it just tells us he's righteous, upright, he was blameless. So there's it on an individual level. And it seems to me, reading the prophets, that, I don't know if this is the purpose of suffering or whatever, but it seems that the poor and the defenseless and the orphan and the widows and so forth that are kind of representatives of that class, that they aren't blamed for their status, that they're brought out, and then the accusation is the people that had stuff didn't help them. So their presence is almost a challenge for response, by the people that do have stuff. So there's not this blaming of the people who have not. You must have somehow sinned or whatever. But it's almost their presence is almost a challenge and a judgment on the people who aren't responding to their suffering. So there's a number of different ways of dealing with suffering, explaining suffering, or interpreting it in the Bible. Any reactions, reflections?
It's a tough one, but it is hard when you're growing up and reading through the Old Testament, not to get that kind of mindset that God punishes the people if they're not true to Him. That's mm-hmm. that's sort of the perception I got from just years and years of Bible study and everything. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's because the writers had that kind of philosophy or something, mm-hmm. that God was punishing the people when they fell away from.
Mm-hmm.
Does it depend on which ones you read?
Probably.
And a lot of them, and you can rattle off who they are, kind of destroy this notion of that there's a cause and effect relationship in everything that we do. Job, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
If I do this, this will happen. And that's a notion that he has to get rid of, it mm-hmm. seems to me, before he can really have a communion as he does at the end with God.
Mm-hmm.
If I do this, I'll be fine. I mean, he even offers his sacrifices in case his kids might have sinned. Just in case they did, I'll
mm-hmm.
so just, Jonah does that. I mean, somehow this, am I right? This cause and effect. If I do this, this will happen. And that's kind of the American ethic.
Mm-hmm.
It's brought over. If we do this, this will happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it's an appropriate response to the situation, you know, when think of the environment, for example. Whoa, now you know, the ozone's going away. And it's appropriate for us to say, wow, well, it seems like
we
have to look at what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, in a number of situations like this, we seem to bring upon ourselves, it's an appropriate time for reflection when bad things happen to us to reflect, well, you know, are we responsible for this? Is it something that we aren't doing, you know, when our poverty rates are rising and so forth, maybe we need to stop and say, well, is it something that we as a community are doing that's causing this? So it's not an inappropriate
response. No, and that's one of the points of it all, is that, mm-hmm. that you can't reduce it to that.
Right.
You can't reduce it to cause and effect, but you also can't overlook that, and it seems to me as you look at this whole thing together, or if we did, we'd say, I wasn't here for discussion, I saw the movie though, the Jews are suffering because of what, right? I don't know what you guys talked about, but that's a common historical response.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve,
mm-hmm.
Same way with 19th century explanations of slavery. To reduce that to cause and effect is a mistake,
mm-hmm.
right?
You know what, I think the difference is there is that in those cases, for example, blaming AIDS patients,
mm-hmm.
you know, because, well, they're somehow guilty, you know, they're sinners or whatever, they deserve punishment or whatever, or, you know, whatever group you want to sort of blame for their condition and see it as punishment, that's looking from the outside at another who's suffering and defining that as punishment, which seems to me to be something very different from what the community in exile did, as they were talking about their own history, right? So it's us, so things are going really wrong for us. So maybe we should reflect on what we've done, you know, to be part of this equation. So there's a different perspective from the inside, which is really what you have here in Isaiah and in all the histories and everything. It's a reflection of a people about their own history, right? And I think, you know, as Christian readers, we have to include ourselves in the us instead of saying, oh, yes, well, it seems like, you know, the Jews were a hard-hearted people, blah, blah, blah. I mean, these are all descriptions here, but this is self-description, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we, as kind of heirs to this tradition, more recent comers, I guess 2,000 years isn't recent now, but that we are part of the we. In all this, and then that's a different, a whole different thing than kind of looking from the outside and saying, oh, well, you know, this group or this group or this group deserves whatever misfortune they have because of what they have done. They're responsible for it.
Would you go back to the fallen man at the beginning?
Mm.
The result, I mean, we had a choice. You know, well, if you have that choice and freedom, you have responsibility with it. So what happens is, because of what was given in the first place. If you go back to the basis of that's why all this problems of the earth are choice at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this model does, of responsibility, does cause us to think about our behavior and how we're acting and so forth. So.
Well, if you think about it, there's no freedom without responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom is there.
Mm-hmm.
Responsibility.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good. Yeah.
Well, that it just popped into my head, this one thing. My husband, in dealing with his teenage kids, sometimes says they have to be willing to deal with the consequences of their action. You know, you can't just
mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's how it is with the human condition. Whatever people are doing, they have to be willing to deal with the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thinking of what there is in the Old Testament, I think the Psalms lots of times kind of reflect the whole mixed up character, you mm-hmm. know, because there's the plea. There's both the mercy and the judgment and the consequences all sort of there. Lots of times in the same psalm,
mm-hmm.
the pleading for mercy as if it's a vengeful God, and then the next
mm-hmm.
next phrase. So I guess it is taking the whole piece to mm-hmm. trying to
mm-hmm. look at all of it. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And there's a lot in Isaiah that's very psalmful. And reminiscent of the Psalms. If we only have a couple more minutes, otherwise I'd take you through through Isaiah 54, which is a beautiful passage, and it talks about actually Zion as personified as a woman. That God is abandoned. So there's an image of sort of Zion as God's wife, and that he's abandoned for just a moment, a brief moment, but his love is eternal. In this contrast, this brief moment of anger with the eternal love. So both that experience of God's absence, which you have in the Psalms, is expressed, but the confidence in a wider history of love and faithfulness and so forth is there as well. Well, the moment we have in 7 through 10 is that announcement of sort of the transformation, right? Of the messenger coming and the change of fortunes and the people learning in the ruins that God reigns, that God is king.
Could this be also the message of grace and forgiveness?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you're thinking about this whole idea was punishment for their sin. Now with the return and restoration, sin, their punishment, does not have the last word, but grace does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And God's mercy has the last
mm-hmm.
word.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I've been pondering.
Yeah, I think so. And then just the singing response, too, of the people.
And that's a cycle, that's a continuous cycle. They blow it. Say I'm sorry, forgiveness, blow it, say I'm sorry. And that's kind of the whole kind of cycle repeated for the history of the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And for us,
church.
Yeah,
yeah, as part of the church as Israel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What strikes me so much in this passage is this messenger coming announcing the reign of God with two ruins. You know, to a place of ruins, and then there's this shouting and singing, even though, you know, it hasn't yet even been rebuilt. Yet there's this announcement of this good news, and it creates a whole different kind of reality for the people there. The possibility.
You might call it faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The substance of something yet unseen.
What do you think about this image of king here in this context? And it's kind of funny that we don't have really powerful kings anymore. It's sort of a remnant. And maybe it's a powerful image. I don't know. But it seems like, you know, we don't have kings. So it's not really drawing on our experience, our own political experience, and making any kind of claim against that. It's not saying, well, God is president. Our ruler's a little less powerful, though, so it might not work. It's sort of an institution that's sort of a remnant in our religious culture, almost, you know, God who's king. Well, not resounding response to that one, but I'm just...
I was just wondering, where was the mention of? In this,
oh, it says your God reigns,
you know,
and actually in the Hebrew it's Elohech Malach. Malach, it's Melech is king, so it's even more pronounced. And you know, we talk about in the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come. You know, so that's also, even though the primary address is his father, still the father is king. That's really the dominant image there too, in this whole idea of kingship. And yeah, you know, we're people that, well, it's a democracy. We don't have this whole relationship to a king. So I wonder if we even sort of get it.
When I read that, I guess I didn't think of God in the context of being a king, because it just says reigns. I thought, you know, that meant more that he's in control or he has the power over everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's these great Psalms 95 to 99. They're all about the reign of God. They use the same phrase. The Lord reigns, or the Lord is king, celebrating God's kingship. And they all start also with this singing, all earth singing, not only people, which is interesting, but it's sort of a cosmic kingship. So you have the heavens singing and the earth singing, everything singing because the Lord reigns. And there's usually a component explaining what difference this makes for human society, that this king rules justly, or that he raises up the weak, you know, takes care of those who can't take care of themselves. But it's sort of like a cosmic song because of the reign of God, really the glorious image. And you know, I'm glad that we've retained king, like the image of the king in the biblical corpus. But I wonder sometimes if we can really grasp what that means to say that, because we don't have that experience to draw on, you know, understanding the metaphor. Because usually a metaphor draws on something that's well known to explain something that's more difficult to grasp. And now, so here we have this metaphor that we have to work to understand in the first place. But, yeah.
Maybe it's more in contrast.
In contrast, know,
That we now, because of media and everything, know the failings of our leaders. So maybe we have to understand it more in contrast and say, what if the people who led us really did it in justice? And, you know, it almost maybe is a contrasting sort of metaphor to say, what would it be like?
And that might free up the imagination to imagine all kinds of things. What would it be like if
because
someone who was completely powerful, completely just?
Because truly the kings at that time were no more just than no more. But we just know more, way more than we want to know. But
other remarks?
I really like the whole image of the king, and that the Bible refers to us as being heirs to the kingdom and heirs of the king. That just gives a real powerful picture to me of someone who's in control of everything and everyone is bowed to, and that we are his children and his lineage. I just think it's just a real powerful picture of being, you know, in the kingdom, child of the king. That's really neat.
You brought up a really good point, because that image of God's kingship emphasizes God's power, but we're creating the image of God to have dominion and so forth. So we're like the viceroys, the sort of the kings, right, on the lower level. So it both elevates the divinity and also our own sort of responsibility and, you know, emulation of that. Good use of power, I guess. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.